correctly here. All right. Today is May 8th, 2009. My name is Varanya Chaubey, and I'm sitting here with Mr. Raphael Trotman, who's Member of Parliament and leader of the Alliance for Change Party in Guyana. Thank you so much, Mr. Trotman, for agreeing to participate in this interview.
Thank you.
We'd like to begin by asking a little bit about your personal background. So would you describe briefly the path that you took to get here and what you're doing with the AFC now?
Personal background. Well, I am a lawyer professionally. I never envisaged a career in politics, quite frankly. After graduating from law school, I found myself drawn to politics, but with the desire to not just be involved or to find myself being elected, but to make some positive change or bring about some positive change. I've always had a passion as well for conflict, understanding conflict and resolving them. So that's it. My parents, I believe, would have had an influence on me in the way I think. I'm a little different in that I have within me East Indian, Chinese, the indigenous Amerindian, African, and some European. So that gave me an opportunity to see things from different perspectives. Because, you know, things are very stratified in Ghana between East Indians and Africans, and that's where the tension lies. So there are many of us, many like me, in the middle, with one or two or more of the mixtures. That's really where I'm coming from. But in terms of the AFC, the idea was that we would form a political party that would get in between and separate the two dominant parties, the PPP Civic and the People's National Congress Reform. Our intention, even though we said so publicly, was not necessary to win elections. It would have been fantastic if we won. But we got a sense leading up to the 2006 elections that we were heading along a dangerous path that was likely to end in some serious bloodshed. And we thought that by our very presence and by being able to offer for the first time a credible alternative to the two, that it would have, one, the impact of, it would impact by reducing tensions, and that people didn't see everything in a zero-sum way. That I either voted for this one or that, and if this happened, that would happen. And secondly, that by our mere presence, it would force the others to adopt less aggressive postures and language. And in fact, we believe that our involvement and participation, along with a lot of work done by the UN and other agencies, did help to calm things to the point where the 2006 elections have been hailed as the most peaceful in decades. We've been attacked viciously for that, accused of being agents of different spy agencies, and that we had an ulterior motive to inject a sense of calm. Our list of candidates did have a number of religious persons, and we have been accused publicly of deliberately injecting these religious personalities as another way of pacifying people. So in as much as we were, our presence was hailed as being partially responsible for the peace, or keeping the peace, some advocates have come out against us and accused us of being part of some grand plan to placate people and to upset, in a sense, what was perhaps planned to be something much bigger, more combustible. The AFC, I believe that in countries like ours, heterogeneous communities and societies, you need third parties, because if everything is seen like I said, in a zero-sum way. It's either you're either red or you're black. You're either with me or against me. People don't want to live like that any longer. They want a chance to be able to either not participate, or if they do choose to participate, to have something other than what is just presented to them as just a two-dimensional matrix that is either this or that. I was personally disappointed that we didn't do better than we did. On the other hand, we did better than any other party had done in the past. But perhaps later in my older years, I can reflect on it and feel that I, you know, was more successful. We are hoping to be in place for the next general elections. I think there are many predictions that we would collapse. So far, with great effort, I should say, we have survived. And we're trying on a daily basis to keep ourselves topical and to try to fill as many spaces as we can whenever we can. That's where the AFC is now.
Now, you mentioned that leading up to the 2006 elections, the AFC had some role to play in calming the situation down. Would you describe some of the activities undertaken to that end?
Well, we ran many, for example, advertisements that said, for example, choose change, by the way, not race. Don't vote race, vote change. We appealed particularly to younger Guyanese, giving them a message of hope. Our little manifesto, guys, we have a copy here, but we stress a lot on healing and reconciliation, how to heal the rifts and to reconcile the differences. And I remember we used a dove, which is, of course, a universal symbol of peace, in that publication. We took out many full-page newspaper advertisements. We'd see with a white dove, speaking about peace and reconciliation. So that message, I believe, resonated. At least it did with about 30,000 people who voted for us. And it had some impact or effect on thousands of others, even though they may not have voted for us, that we became identified, in a sense, as the peace party. People wanted us, saw us as the party that wanted to bring healing. And we were the ones saying that the time has come to stop the fighting, and it's not helping anyone. So those are some of the things that we did then.
Now, the 2006 elections were hailed by the Carter Center as the most peaceful that the country has had. Would you describe some of the reforms in electoral administration or changes in policy legislation that may have been put in place in the period between the 2001 and 2006 elections that may have contributed towards this atmosphere?
I don't know. Quite frankly, I'm not very close to the electoral process to tell you whether the reforms per se had an impact. I think it was more the presence of an involvement of the donor community than it was, say, the mechanism. And a lot had to do with, I believe, that the UNDP had a social, ran a program that helped a great deal. Yeah, but I don't think it was necessary that people had renewed confidence in GCOM or the electoral systems. It was a function, I think, of people becoming just tired and being worn out. Secondly, the heavy presence of observers helped. And the messages that were coming from the religious community, civil society, before the elections, was one that says no violence. I think those helped tremendously. There were no fundamental changes in the system between 2001 and 2006. I believe at most we may have had more polling places, but not significantly many more. But there were still many hiccups on the day of the election itself. But I wouldn't credit GCOM's, not to say, I wouldn't credit GCOM as being solely responsible or largely responsible. At the same time, I'm not at all discounting that GCOM had a role and did play an important role. One of them, of course, is being able to produce an election result in a matter of days rather than weeks. We've had situations here where it has taken some time to get an official result. I believe that helped as well. The AFC, unwittingly or not, we had working alongside us this Dick Morris. You've heard of Dick Morris? Okay. Dick Morris was Bill Clinton's advisor that got Clinton into the White House. So Morris's presence in Guyana, and he had brought with him some internationally known pollsters. And I think their presence, there were some guys who had just worked on the Mexican president's campaign, Calderon. Their presence, I believe, and talk of an exit poll. They said they were going to run an exit poll. I think it helped to sharpen GCOM a bit too, because the chairman of the commission had contacted me and asked me not to publish the results of this exit poll if we did it, for fear that if the exit poll came out before GCOM was able to, would be a problem. And if it came out before and with a different result to that which GCOM produced, would be another problem. So we had an understanding that whatever information we got from our exit poll, we would not make public. But at the same time, I think it had the indirect effect of causing GCOM to be a little more alert and to step up its pace far more than it would have normally, because there was now an outside pressure to produce a result far quicker than they'd done in the past. Forgot about that.
Mm. Now, this is an interesting avenue you chose to pursue. Are there any other such examples of ways in which you worked alongside or you presented options to GCOM which helped shape some of their work?
The truth is, there must have been, but none. I just remember that one, the exit poll. But nothing comes to mind immediately. Maybe during the course of the discussion, something will come up. But that one, I just remember that GCOM and the chairman and I, Dr. Suze Bali, had a conversation and an agreement that we would not publish this exit poll.
Now, in terms of conducting the exit poll, were you involved in planning it?
No, I had nothing to do with it at all.
One of the things that has been covered widely in the media is this issue of scrutineers. Would you like to explain a little bit what the debate is about?
Well, I'd love to. I think I will locate it to 2006. It was our understanding from GCOM that when the nomination day was announced, which is the way it's done here, we all became contesting parties. And there was no government in opposition because Parliament was dissolved. But because I think of the dominance of the two, that really didn't obtain. The playing field was never level. So much so that we discovered about 2 days before the elections that some $12 million had been shared between the two parties for the payment of their polling day scrutineers and agents. This is from the government's money.
From budget.
Yes. There was a quiet deal. So they each party got $6 million from the state's funds.
It's a Ghana dollars.
Yes, this would be equivalent to what? Divided by 200. 6,000 US dollars. It does sound like a lot, but it pays for your polling day. It gives them a little honorarium and perhaps a meal or two so that they will stay vigilant. None of the other opposition parties, so put another way, none of the other contesting parties were made aware that this money had been approved by the Minister of Finance and disbursed. So right away the playing field was not level. I was very disappointed that when the deal was struck, Dr. Suresh Bali was present at the office of the president. It was he who alerted us, but said that there was nothing he could do about it. Now, I would have thought that as chairman of GCOM, he could have publicly protested. I think he tried to make amends by alerting us that this money was shared out. That's one infraction. Second infraction was that we were all required to produce lists of our polling day scrutineers, or polling agents as they called them on that day. And I started getting reports that from our agents that they were being telephoned and offered employment by GCOM. So we had agreed to pay our people, say, I think 2,000 Ghana dollars, which would be equivalent to about $10 US, with meals. GCOM had called and was offering them $10,000, which is $50, with meals. It was very offensive, because that is all that we could have afforded. And if we submitted our list to GCOM for accreditation, GCOM's officials had no right to then go through our list and call up our people, because you had to put accompanying address and contact numbers and offer them employment to fill their own quotas. I called Dr. Suresh Bali. He apologized. He laughed. He says it's a free market system we're operating in. I said, but this is unfair. You wouldn't risk that with the other parties. But again, he promised to his credit, he said he would put an end to it immediately, which he did. By which time, damage had been done. We had lost, I would say, about 15% of the persons on our list. And to go and recruit new people, it was difficult. And then the psychological impact of us offering $2,000, when it was then public that others were being offered $10,000. I mean, so people abandoned us. They liked us, yes. But if I'm getting a $10,000 there, I need the money. So that was a second, I'm sorry about this. That was a second infraction. A third happened on election day itself, where when our polling agents turned up to man the polling booths on behalf of the AFC, they were told that they needed a letter of appointment. Now, you polling starts at 6 a.m. You got to be present from 5, check the polling place, check the box, make sure it's not tampered with, it's empty of any ballots, make sure that your pens are working and all that. So at 6 o'clock, they're told that they're not accredited because there's no letter of appointment. We start getting the reports at about 7 or 8 in the morning. By the time I get to Dr. Suresh Bali, it's 10 a.m. He says, it's nonsense. Where did that come from? That's the level of mischief. He may be operating at that level, but those below who have party affiliation, and we believe, and we have proof of it, that the two bigger ones were conspiring and colluding against us. So they sent out this message to the presiding officers, that a letter of appointment was necessary. So got on to Dr. Suraj Bali. He promised, he said it was nonsense indeed, and he would put an end to it, which he did. But again, the damage done between 6 a.m. and about 11 o'clock was tremendous. In some instances, we were not able to observe the pole from 6 to, say, 10 or 11. In many instances, particularly in the rural areas, people left and went home in anger or frustration. And there was little or no way of contacting them by phone or otherwise to say, this problem has been cleared up, return to your post. So, according to our records, we were unable to have people at least about 25% of the polling places because of this problem. And we had our full complement. But because of the problem or the letter of appointment nonsense, we were unable to have people there. So it goes back to 2006. Fast forward to 2008. We all gather at the office of the president, and what's the word they use? They like big words in Guyana. Either not a treaty or an MOU, some fancy thing is signed between the political parties, the parliamentary political parties, and the donor community. That is going to be a new house-to-house registration process, a verification, and this will lead to a new list, and that new list will lead to local government elections and elections, then to continuous registration. Fine. But then lo and behold, we are all individual signatories. Lo and behold, the money is shared between the PPP and the PNC.
The money for?
The payment of scrutineers. Even though, as I said, the agreement signed at the office of the president was not signed between the government and the leader of the opposition on behalf of the opposition parties. We were all, in a sense, signatories and stakeholders. But when and this amounted to over $1 million for the payment of party scrutineers. We were told that if we wanted money, we had to go to the leader of the opposition and ask for it, which we did. He then said, put up a work program. We needed to put up a work program as to how we were going to spend this money, which we found to be atrocious. We might be opposition parties alike, and there should be a certain level of camaraderie. But we felt that it was an affront to us, notwithstanding that we numbered just 5 in Parliament in terms of seats, to be asked to put up a work program. In other words, we were being asked to justify how this money was going to be spent by us, like children.
Did the opposition party, the PNC, have to also...
No, because they have the money. They were just handed the money. But when we went for what we thought was our proportional share, we were told to put up a work program and in which regions we'll have and how many people, in a sense making it impossible for us to get the money. We then decided to approach the courts for an interpretation of the law. Court ruled that GCOM, as the independent moderator, arbiter, should be responsible for the disbursement of this money for the scrutinizing of this process, and not the leader of the opposition, and that the money should be apportioned on a proportionality basis. So you have 10% of the seats, you get 10% of the money. Simple arithmetical calculation. GCOM, and this is what I think is my 5th infraction against GCOM. GCOM appealed the court ruling. And so for the first time in the courts, it is GCOM versus a political party, which should never, ever, ever have happened. GCOM stopped being neutral. That's the company.
Fifth infraction.
I'm coming to the fifth infraction, GCOM and ASC. We went to court not naming anyone as a defendant or a respondent. Just asking the court for an interpretation, which you're allowed to do under our legal procedures. Asking the court to interpret or give meaning to a particular bit of legislation or regulation. And the court interpreted it to say that the political parliamentary party shall share the money on a proportional basis. The frighteningly surprising thing that happened was that GCOM, and not the PNC, from whom the money would have had to come from, appealed to the Court of Appeal.
Why do you think they did this? Is it just not to enter into the fray, or what?
But they have entered into the fray. By becoming an appellant in a legal matter, it was then GCOM versus AFC. And how can you be seen as an independent arbiter if you have taken up a legal challenge against a political party in Guyana? It really has damaged my confidence. The Court of Appeal affirmed the decision of the lower court, awarding costs in favor of the AFC against GCOM, which has never been paid. So the matter became contentious. From merely seeking a declaratory or order or an interpretation of the law, GCOM made it contentious when it made itself a party and challenged. And since then, as I said, the communication between GCOM and the AFC has grown to a halt. Things are said at cocktail parties and at functions. Curse words apparently have been exchanged. Snide remarks. So I saw Dr. Suraj Bali at a reception for the Queen of England's birthday, the British High Commissioner's residence of last year. He says, I have a mail for you, but the AFC doesn't seem to have an office. Our office had been damaged by flood. But he was making this sarcastic comment that we were like a fly-by-night party without an office. But that's a kind of that, almost like mockingly. And so as it is now, we have no representation on the commission. We have no contact or communication with GCOM. We are not advised, updated, consulted, briefed on anything. It's really sad. I have tried to get people I know to perhaps mediate, but it really will be something that has to be dealt with before the next elections. Because at some stage I'm going to publicly say, if it continues like this, that we have no confidence in GCOM because of all these things that have happened. But more so because of the continuance of this behavior. Particularly where, as I said, there are no letters or we know nothing. What we know is what we read in the newspapers. So that was, I think, the fifth. The sixth infraction, of course, is, as I said, making things so contentious now to the point where we're not speaking to each other. Sad. But that's where things are then.
Now, this seems to have come to a head after the 2006 election.
Yes.
What were the moves GCOM took? What were the moves GCOM took leading up to the 2006 election? I'd like to get a sense of the sorts of communications you had during that phase. Would you describe the issues you were consulted on and briefed on? How did that relationship, how was it before this came to a head?
It was – good. We were consulted. We did feel that things were not as level as they ought to be, but we were consulted. We did have a right of audience. Like I said, even though there were transgressions, whenever I made contact with Dr. Shuzbali, to his credit, he dealt with them immediately. Notwithstanding the fact that it should not have happened, but whenever he was alerted that we had a complaint, he addressed our complaints. So, in the pre-2006 or leading up to the elections, I would say that GCOM, the relationship between GCOM and the AFC, or vice versa, was good. And we had confidence in GCOM and its ability to discharge its functions. I still believe that GCOM is capable of discharging its functions, but I'm concerned that personal issues have colored GCOM's ability to look at the AFC as a political party that has certain rights and entitlements.
Now, during that period, what were the sorts of issues that they would consult with you on or have briefings?
Well, the regular things they would hold, they would consult us about the elections schedule to see whether it was being kept, our comments, appointment of agents, scrutineers, training sessions, concerns about language, campaign material. It was very consultative. Dr. Shuzbali was proactive. If he felt that something was said at a rally or that a particular party was not conducting itself in a manner befitting of a good modern wholesome party, he would make it known. He might send a message to a friend through a friend to get to me, and I have no doubt he did this with the other parties. So it's a stark difference today, what obtains today as against what was, and that's why it's so glaring.
Now, have there been attempts by, you mentioned one of the ways in which GCOM tried to perhaps maintain some sort of code of conduct is to monitor what parties were doing. Mm. What might have been some of the other things that GCOM did or the government did to try and ensure that, or to try and, to some degree, level the playing field?
I don't want to be cynical, but I don't think government did much, if anything at all. Just before elections, for example, the entire cabinet went out on a cabinet outreach around the country, which 3 months before an election, using state funds to campaign. I think GCOM, in tandem with the donor community, the OAS, and I need to give credit to the OAS in particular, Ramdani, anyway, he's Surinamese, I think the Deputy Director General of the OAS, came here often. His presence, I thought, and his involvement and his diplomacy was very good. But I wouldn't credit the government. It was more GCOM working with international agencies and the donor community that set the tone for a successful election.
And what were some of the ways in which they did that work?
Like I said, the OAS, I think, took the lead by setting up an office here months before the elections, perhaps even a year before, which was quite different to past elections when observers would come a month before and come skirting around and sniffing around. But this was about an office established about a year before. And there were almost monthly visits from Washington. And we were kept abreast. And that I thought was very helpful. The ERC and UNDP did, I remember now, it was a social cohesion program. I remember an expert had been brought in from South Africa, meeting leaders and looking at possible triggers for violence and how to diffuse them. That I believe was helpful. But there was a greater presence of an international community. And that helped a lot.
One of the things I read about was the media monitoring unit that GCOM established to monitor the language used across various media. What were your views on the efficacy?
Well, I had very little contact with the unit because, of course, I was out on a daily basis. There were some, I thought they functioned, but there were some very damaging ads that came out, which the media unit was too slow to react to. So by the time they were pulled, it would have been like 72 hours or more after the damage had been done. But I still think that the media monitoring unit was a useful component and helpful. Yes, it was. But of course, it's to me, hopefully in the next occasion, they'll be far better organized than they were now.
You mentioned that during the issue of scrutineers, it was taken to the court. Were there any other tactics used alongside either using the media to inform the public or to raise public debate on this issue?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was very public, well publicized. The fact that we were going to court, the fact that we were fighting for what we thought was our just entitlements. So I don't think that the public was well aware, but it came down to having to go to court to get our, what we thought would have been justice, but we didn't in the end.
I'd like to talk now a little bit about polling and counting on election day. Would you speak about any aspects of the polling and counting that you think have improved or not improved over the past elections?
Well, certainly the counting, the fact that there were more polling places was helpful because it lessened the number of people who voted and therefore made it easier to have the poll and quicken the count at the end of poll. The availability of material. In past elections, there's always some confusion about insufficient ballot papers or something. I think this time around there was, if at all, there was in excess. Also, the transmission of the results, the system to get that done, I'm not too aware of how it was set up, but that seemed to be far superior than anything before. And that seemed to have worked better than previous elections. So that GCOM got the results quicker. I didn't mention to you the most serious infraction against the AFC, have I?
No, not yet.
By GCOM?
No.
Sorry to do this to you. How could this have slipped me? We have regional seats. And in a place known as Region Number 10, which is near the mining community, the AFC won one of the two seats. GCOM announced that the PPP had won the seat. How could you do that? Using their statements of poll, we show them, just simply add, we won. At a meeting called by Dr. Suresh Bali, which I went in January of 2007, he explained that a mistake was made. He apologized, and he asked that we not see it as a deliberate move to disenfranchise the AFC or the people of that community, but that the lawyers had advised that once the pronouncement had been made, rightly or wrongly, he was statutorily bound by whatever had been pronounced, and only a court following a petition filed could overturn what he had said. And so we filed our petition. That's since in May of 2009, we still can't get the court to hear our case. And GCOM have sworn affidavits saying that the AFC has a pretended claim to the seat. That's the language. After Dr. Sujbali admitted to us, and it is now, it is established that a mistake has been made. The Prime Minister of Ghana occupies the seat which the AFC won. Unashamedly, it doesn't seem to matter to him. And the Prime Minister occupies the seat as a representative of this community when it was we who won that seat. The fact that Dr. Sujbali could, in a meeting with several persons, say to us that a mistake, in fact, he brought the statements of poll to show where the mistake was made, and he put it down to either the presiding officer being tired or maybe trying to get done mistakes are made, training, the kind of people you got to work with, not very bright and all that. We believe that this would have been a simple matter that would have been taken care of in a matter of weeks. We're led to believe that. 3 years after, we are still hoping to get a court to hear our petition. But what has hurt and affected us most is that GCOM has taken the position of the government. The government is saying, no, the AFC didn't win this seat. And GCOM has joined with similar language, saying that it is a pretended claim, even though their certified statements of poll are what we have used as exhibits to support our. We have our own, but we thought that to strengthen our case, we would not use our statements of poll, but the ones that GCOM delivered to us, their copies. And they're just 100 and something of them to count. 50, 17, and the count is clear that we won. That is the sixth and most serious infraction, AFC or GCOM versus the AFC. We would have thought that GCOM would have taken the high moral ground and independent ground and said, this is what happened. It may have been a mistake, but we are statutorily bound by it. And maybe there's nothing we can do, but at least speak the truth. That one is serious. Mm-hmm. Sorry to transgress.
On the issue of scrutineers, for instance, mm-hmm. when you took it to the court did rule in your favor. Mm-hmm. What would you ascribe that to? How did that come about?
Ruling in the favor of the AFC? Because it was a very commonsensical argument. There is $200 million to be disbursed, to be paid to political party scrutineers. There are, in Parliament, 4 political parties that are entitled to share in this money. What would be the best means of ensuring that they share? And we proposed that on a proportional basis, based on the number of seats you have and your numerical strength, and the court accepted the argument. The matter went to the Court of Appeal of Guyana, and the Court of Appeal of Guyana agreed that the argument had merit and the judge's ruling had merit. So it, to us, it was a simple matter that any court would have ruled that way on. It was not a contentious issue. And remember, we had just asked the court to interpret a section of the law. How should, the law says that party scrutineer shall be paid, but it was silent as to how this payment is to be disbursed. We asked the court to give effect, in a sense, to how this should be done. I should tell you that 2 weeks ago, the government came to Parliament and passed a law supported by the PNC that says that the money goes to the opposition. So they have defeated the ruling of the court and shut us out again. Serious.
I'd like to move a little bit into the security mm-hmm. aspect of the mm-hmm. election, since this was a peaceful election. Mm-hmm. What were the sorts of security arrangements made, and in your view, how well did they work?
Security. Honestly, I'm not very familiar with the day-to-day security, the details rather, because I was, like I said, out campaigning. But there, I'd like to commend the Commissioner of Police. I think he did a good job with the resources that were available to him. That helped. And then, you know, we have in Guyana voting before the disciplined forces vote, about a week before, so that on election day they are available. And in barracks or in their stations, and not voting. They've already voted. I don't think that, again, that the absence of violence was as a result of better security arrangements. I wouldn't say so. I don't think that any of the new arrangements the arrangements put in place were that much better or different from that which obtained in the past. I think it was more, again, the effect of different things happening on the outside that placated. People were just calm, like if they'd been drugged or something. It was strange. The churches were very involved. There was a lot of praying going on. There were ads on TV with gospel singing and different personalities, sport personalities and others appealing for calm. A lot of that helped. I mean, you were bombarded with that. And again, the language on the platform was not vicious as it was before. The standard was a little higher. I'm not, again, not discounting entirely the security arrangements, but given the fact that they were not tested at all, we don't know how they would have stood up. I would give more credit to a lot of the work being done on the outside by social activists and so on.
Now, you mentioned that there was an increase of participation from religious groups and other entities who were mm-hmm. urging calm. Was this part of a coordinated effort on part of civil society? Or
yes, it was. Much of it was coordinated. And I think the UNDP's social cohesion program or project played a great part. But on their own, there was this sense of doom, that people felt that the 2006 elections would be the mother of all elections, and that the country was going to break up. It helped, I think, to push everyone else to the brink. They didn't want this breakup to happen. But a lot of the religious people on their own were involved in a lot of praying and calling for calm, because there was this sense that something cataclysmic was about to happen in Guyana. And I think the reality or the possibility of this thing really happening scared people to the point where they decided that I better not get involved in this. So like I said on television, a lot of the messages were for calm, for peace, not to be diverted, distracted, or taken along any dangerous pathways, listening to people who call for violence and so on.
On the subject of the media, I'd like to ask you about access to media for various parties. In your view, is that...
I don't have... there were reports published which showed, depending on which television station you looked at or which newspaper you read, that different parties had greater or lesser access. But I think that, speaking for the AFC, I believe we got a fair, as a newcomer, because we had only been formed 9 months before the election date. And I think we picked up fair coverage. Would have liked to have more, but we got fair coverage for a party that had just come on the scene, literally.
Now, you come from a legal background. Mm. What is your view on the legal basis for conducting elections in Guyana, the legislative framework? Some reports suggest it's too diffuse and it needs to be consolidated, all the laws under one umbrella. Do you have views on this?
I'm not too sure. I've never really examined it from that angle. I've always examined it from the angle of whether or not the system is working. I'm more concerned right now about the local government elections being held or not held with reforms. But at the end of the day, I think we Guyanese have to remember and remind ourselves that we're less than 1 million people. The voters list might hit 500,000. And there's too much changing and adapting and engineering for 500,000 people. So bringing all the laws into one comprehensive one law, or having it dispersed over 10 documents, is neither here nor there for me. Because, like I said, it's not rocket science. This is 2009. Computers do a fantastic job. And it's more about working the system rather than continuing to tinker and change laws and change. The size of our electorate is sometimes a little tongue in the U.S. or some other place. And they get a result and they get the business done quite efficiently. And I don't see why we can't. I mean, we have rural communities and we take cognizance of that fact that things might be a little more, the degree of difficulty would be a little greater. But that's not to say that we can't deliver to them elections or the mechanisms in a timely manner and get the result declared in a timely manner. We're not 1 million people. So I'm not in favor of great reform just for the sake of saying reform. The laws need to be perhaps the ones that we have need to be observed rather than be changed and adapted all the time. There's always need for refining, but I don't see this idea for a total overhaul being necessary.
You mentioned local government elections. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the next or has been long awaited, in fact. In your view, how important are they, and do you feel like they will take place in the prescribed time frame?
They're important. Well, the prescribed time frame, we're off by many years already. I think that the importance of local government elections in Ghana is not being underscored sufficiently. And I say so because in the context of a country with its diversity like Guyana, you can actually deliver a greater strain of or purer strain of democracy at the local level than perhaps you can at the national level. Sounds strange. But if individual communities and little villages had more direct responsibility for their affairs, it may not matter to them as much who's president of Guyana or who's a member of parliament, because I can raise my own taxes, I can decide whether this bridge is repaired or that road is fixed, or whether this school is going to be built and who the teacher is going to be. And that is what I believe is very important for Guyana. But we're talking about elections in the absence of meaningful reforms, or that kind of reform. The kind of reform which would have led to the power being devolved to the people, to take some of this burden or this responsibility away from the center, that it has to take care of everything and everyone. And when you cannot, because of scarcity of resources or otherwise, you get blamed for discriminating. Sometimes you're not. But the perception is that you're discriminating against me because you've done the bridge in community A and you've forgotten me in community B. Sometimes it's just a matter of programming or availability of resources. But if communities A and B both got an equal amount of money from the state's coffers, and each had the ability to make their own decisions as to how this money is going to be spent, road or bridge, then blaming the government in power, it would to a great extent neutralize the ability of someone to point a finger and say, you have discriminated against me because I look different to you, or because I live in a community that is different to yours. And that to me is why these elections, or put another way, why local government reform is so important. And any elections which are to be held should reinforce that importance, rather than just be an exercise that just said we've held elections for the sake of holding elections. Because it will just repeat and entrench what we have now, which is what I'm fearing is about to happen.
And in your view, what is the reason that the process has stalled so long?
It's a combination of many things. Guyana, our politics, we have our default mode, without realizing it, is we only function when in crisis. So we go in, we undulate. In a year's time, there's going to be a dialogue of some type. Then that is going to collapse, so we hit a trough. And then someone from somewhere is going to speak to the leaders, and then they're going to speak again, and then we resume speaking, and then that breaks down. It is just the pattern of the way things are done in Ghana, that's by itself. And then you throw into that the high level of distrust, dislike. The government, I don't think that we've practiced anything near an orthodox type of politics in Ghana since particularly 1997. So the government exists every day, I might use a bad analogy here, almost like the government of Israel operates, and wakes up every day with the belief that they are hungry wolves waiting to move in and consume it. So it has led to a kind of a siege mentality, the distrusting. And if I put up a proposal, or another person, citizen puts up a proposal, excellent. But the first thing you do is reject the proposal. First thing, standard. Then about 2 months later you go back and you sniff around it. And you agree that it's good, but then you want to know, why did this citizen suggest it? Does he really like me, or he has an ulterior motive? Something is up. And then another 2 months later there's a decision to implement a quarter of the proposal and not the whole. So by the time you get around to the whole, circumstances have overtaken everything, so you now need to go back to the drawing board and design everything out of again. Sounds a little bizarre, but this is my little theory and what's happening in Guyana. So you get a lot of finger pointing and blame through. It's your fault, and both sides are probably right, and they both see it through a different prism, that it's your fault, you're delaying, and not me, you are. They both are right and they're both wrong. They both probably, and that's the PNC and the PPP, particularly for this local government reform. They've been locked together in a meeting for the last 8 years. The local government task force was established in 2001. Talks broke down last month in 2009 because they weren't making headway. Now imagine after 8 years, you were in a task force. And that in itself suggests some degree of urgency and action. It's an action-oriented place. 8 years, and both sides consistently blame each other for the breakdown. That's just the way things happen or don't happen in Guyana. And then they hit a thing, and then somebody has to come in and placate and talk and stroke a few egos, and then they resume talking again, and then it breaks down again. And that's how we've been going for the last 10, 12 years.
Well, we've covered a lot of topics, and now I'd like to ask you if there's anything you would like to bring up that I haven't brought up.
Nothing I could think of, except that, as I said before, that I like the idea of this project, and this I'll certainly be going to read up on it some more. And the whole concept of successful societies, how do you measure them? How do you measure success, and how to replicate successes in other countries? And it could be the little things like removing your refuse. If community A has the ability to have its refuse properly removed and discarded, it wouldn't blame the government. Because all of a sudden, indeed, you stop looking only at the garbage and you start looking at the roads, the schools, everything becomes a problem. But if at least there was one or maybe two success stories, life is far better for you. And you are appreciative of the fact that not everything is fixable at the same time. But you get a sense if nothing is happening that, you know, everything has collapsed. So I'll check on it.
I'm glad you're going to read up on this, and if you have any suggestions, we'll be happy to hear. Thank you so much for participating in this interview.
Thank you very much.